organize the meeting and I need to choose a fellows lecture, I thought it would be appropriate to have someone who was recently elected a fellow. Caroline Hoxbee will be our speaker today, and she was elected a fellow of the Society of Labor Economists last year. So this is, I think it's a nice way to do it. I've known Caroline for a long time. I'm one of her teachers, actually, in an earlier life. And I can't say I was her advisor because I left MIT just as she was in the middle of her program, but we did work together, and I'm proud to say, proud to take some fraction of credit, but only a tiny fraction. Anyway, Caroline Hoxbee is one of the leading researchers on the economics of education, and particularly higher education. She's got some wonderful things. She's going to talk to us today about higher education. She's a professor at Stanford University. I'm sure you all know who she is. She who needs no introduction. She's one of the leading scholars in this area, and she's going to talk to us today about some work she's been doing on valuing higher educational institutions. I think I've got that right. Yes. So, without further ado, I give you Caroline Hoxbee.
So I'm going to make one correction, which is that I believe Hank was one of my thesis advisors, and I'll go back and look to see if I've got a signature. All right. Okay, so today I'm going to be talking about the productivity of U.S. post-secondary institutions, and this is a kind of broad, sweeping paper I hope you will see. I'm using tax data in this paper, so there's a usual disclaimer on the first slide. All right, so why does the productivity of post-secondary institutions matter to us? Why should we care? Well, the first reason is something just about economic growth, about our economies. In countries like ours, in highly developed economies, the most growth-oriented industries are the ones that are intensive in advanced skills. This is a long-term trend for us. This is also something that's true of a lot of the other highly advanced countries. Now, if we want to maintain a comparative advantage in advanced skill industries, we need to actually have a highly productive education sector. We don't just need to spend money on it. We actually need to be productive. I'll let you guys think through that for yourselves, but that's the logic. In addition, there are a lot of policy reasons why we might care about the productivity of post-secondary institutions. For instance, anytime I have a policy like a tax credit or a tax deduction for higher education and it subsidizes college going today on the theory that people will earn more later and be able to pay for the next generation of students who are going through college, that really depends on the idea that the education is productive. So I ought to know whether the education is productive. We also have a lot of policies that induce a student to attend one particular institution instead of another. If we're doing that, we ought to know something about their relative productivity. Okay, why else might we care about the productivity of post-secondary institutions? Well, there are a lot of choices that we make that determine what our post-secondary sector is like. Examples would be what financing mechanisms we use. Should we use loans? Should we use grants? Should we use government appropriations? Those are what fund public universities in the United States. Should we mainly have families financing higher education? Well, those things might have implications for productivity, and of course we can't make any progress on those things if we don't know anything about productivity. There are also some questions about markets, and I'm very interested in markets in higher education. Does it matter whether the institutions are competing for students and faculty, or is it just as good to have them be very local, sort of in little autarchies, where everyone just goes to their local college and faculty just teach at their local school? Or should we have a centralized assignment mechanism, as many other countries do? You know, we have much more of a market, and I'll get to that in one second. We have much more of a market. Does that matter for productivity? And then finally, I think another thing that's going to be very obvious when we start looking at the data is we can have an environment in which all the post-secondary institutions are kept relatively similar. That's true in a lot of countries, including a lot of highly advanced countries, highly advanced economies. Or should we instead have a post-secondary sector that exhibits a lot of verticality or assortative matching? I'll be using both of those words interchangeably, verticality or assortative matching. By that I mean that students who are more apt are associated with institutions that have greater educational resources per student. That would be assortative matching in the way I'm going to use the word. If we have that assortative matching, Should the gradient be very steep? Should the top most selective institutions with the most apt students have 10 times the resources, 20 times the resources, 2 times the resources, 1.5 times the resources of the least selective institutions? Those are all reasons to care about measuring productivity. And then finally, let's say you're not at all interested in any of these policy questions or the other things that I've talked about so far. There is a way in which the US is the best place for understanding just how higher education is produced. And the reason is that US post-secondary education has developed quite organically. And there are it's developed through students making individual student choices, which are not particularly well coordinated, and through market forces. And even the rise of things like information, the fact that we have the SAT and the ACT, our two college assessment tests, and the rise of information about colleges, college guidebooks, things like that, have been driven largely by private forces, not by the government. And we have a lot of change that goes on in the higher education sector in the United States. You know, a lot of people in this room are at institutions that are very stable and don't change very much over time, but they are not representative. In fact, higher education institutions are changing rapidly all the time in the US, and we have new ones arising and other ones that die. So just as in any type of industry, we can learn about the production function better if market forces are stronger because firms are pushed out towards the production possibility frontier. In the case of education, higher education, I think we can learn a lot from the US precisely because student choices and market forces are probably much stronger here than they are in a lot of countries where higher education is bureaucratically controlled. Okay, so let me tell you what's novel in today's talk, and then I'll give you a little outline of where we're going. I'm going to show you direct estimates of most post-secondary institutions' productivity. And I'm not going to claim that they're 100% free from selectivity bias, but they're about as free as I think you're going to see for a while, I hope. And I think that evidence is fairly unique. So far, we do not have evidence like this. I'm going to combine this with some evidence from previous papers, and that's going to give us some, I think, a picture, a sort of tapestry of what the economics of higher education looks like, and I think you'll see that it implies something about what models might make sense. And when I say we're going to look at direct evidence on productivity, I really mean evidence from students' earnings. That's the sort of evidence that we need most for our economic models, is how much more does someone earn if they go to a certain post-secondary institution. And I think that's useful evidence in part because most employers of well-educated people are paying them more or less for their productivity. There aren't a lot of wage distortions probably in this part of the market, although there are a lot of labor economists here, so you all can disagree with me about that. And all that I'm really trying to do here is say, look, if I have two equally apt students and they attend two post-secondary schools and the two post-secondary schools spend the same amount on education, but systematically one school produces students with higher earnings than the other, then we can assume that the first school is more productive in terms of things that are valued by the labor market. So that's all that I mean by that. Okay, and then finally, you know, we all know that there are skills that are valued by society but not the labor market, and they're clearly not going to be measured here. If we didn't believe in that, then I think all of us should leave right now and go work on Wall Street. So we believe that, but I don't think that's going to be important for the evidence we look at today. Okay, what's the outline from here? I'm going to tell you a little bit about the institutional background. That's not only for the non-Americans who are here, but for the many Americans who are associated usually with highly non-representative post-secondary institutions in the US. I'm going to give you a little evidence from some previous studies of mine. Then I'm going to tell you how I computed the institution's productivity. This is kind of the hardcore part of this paper. And I'm very glad to talk to people more about the details and refer you to the papers that are in the background, but I'm only going to give you a light, sort of 1,000-foot view of that. Give you some evidence. That's going to be the core of the paper today. A simple model that fits key facts. I'm going to test the model a little bit further by looking for some departures from the model, and then draw some general lessons. Okay, so institutions. In the United States, we have about 8,000 post-secondary institutions. They differ widely on admissions, selectivity, that's admission standards, that's what we mean by selectivity. Their resources, how much they spend per pupil, what curriculum they are, its size. There are schools that have 10,000 students per class, schools that have 20 students per cohort. That's totally okay. And of course, we have
three different types of post-secondary institutions, those that are controlled by state and local governments. Those are public institutions. Nonprofit private institutions, those are things like Vanderbilt, University of Chicago, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford. They're all non-profit privates, but there are many, many more. And we have a rising sector of for-profit private institutions. We've had for-profits around for a long time, but this sector is getting a lot bigger. There's a lot of growth among the for-profits. And I'll come back to that again in a moment. Institutions in the United States have enormous autonomy by international standards. The for-profits and the nonprofits essentially are completely autonomous. They can do whatever they like in terms of setting tuition, application requirements, their students, their faculty, their curriculum, salaries, how to distribute financial aid, how to raise money, et cetera. Even the public institutions, which you may not regard as being as autonomous because you're used to thinking about the private institutions in the US, turn out to be extremely autonomous by international standards. Okay, we do not have a central system that allocates all the faculty to different public universities in the United States, as many other countries have that are highly developed countries. And finally, institutions can admit students based on almost any criteria. Most of the selective institutions say, and probably do, admit students in a way that's fairly holistic, taking a lot of different things into account. But in practice, the thing that is best at predicting whether a student is admitted to a university or other post-secondary institution is their college assessment score. And when I say more selective, what I mean is that the students at that school have higher test scores. I'm not talking about admissions rates or matriculation rates or anything like that. Those are both garbagey measures of selectivity. The only thing that matters is how high the scores are of the students, and I'm going to convert all of the scores into the SAT. Okay, a few more things. Net tuition in the United States is how much a student actually pays. This is not equal to list price tuition or the sticker price, people call it different things, the full pay tuition. Those two things can diverge strongly, especially for more selective schools. And list tuition is also not equal to how much the school is spending to produce an undergraduate education. So most strikingly, just to give you a sense of how completely out of line these things can be, the most selective schools in the United States, they're all non-profit. Private schools have very high list tuition, often above $60,000 a year, but they are free for low-income students, so clearly list and net tuition are not the same thing. And they also subsidize all of their students to the tune of about 50% of the cost of an education, and they use alumni gifts to do that. So these three things are different: net, list, and how much they're spending to educate a student. The difference between the lowest spending and highest spending schools in the United States in terms of their educational resources per student is about 10 times, an order of magnitude. In fact, if I were to take the real extremes, it would be more like 25 times. But for the groups I'm going to be looking at today, 10 times is a good number to keep in mind. Our federal government does not control any schools in the United States. Its main interventions are in doing student loans and giving grants to low-income students and military veterans. And finally, I think it will be helpful for the rest of this talk if you think of the US post-secondary sector as something like a market that has a lot of distortions in it, okay, lots of distortions in it. Don't think of it as a centrally controlled sector the way it is in a lot of other countries. Okay, so what's the key evidence I'm gonna show you from some previous work? The first is about geographic integration. So in 1875, if you looked at US post-secondary education, what you would see was that everyone just went pretty much to their local post-secondary institution. So we were more or less an autarky. Over the beginning of the 20th century, there was more and more geographic integration, and that became very rapid after 1950. And essentially, that's because information on students and information on institutions improved extremely rapidly after World War II, and I could go into that in a lot of detail. As the market became more integrated, the highest aptitude students in the United States tended more and more to go to to institutions that had the most resources per pupil. I'm going to show you that evidence in a second. Okay, and that's really a phenomenon, especially about higher aptitude students. Of course, not all high aptitude students come from families that are rich or even middle class. So. Lots of those high aptitude students could not pay for those resources up front at the time they were going to school. So the way that this worked was that there were increasingly large subsidies for students at more selective institutions. And a consequence of this is that the correlation between parents' income and educational resources fell. It was more or less because the correlation between aptitude and educational resources was rising. I'm not going to show you a slide on that, but I'd be glad to show you that from another paper. Okay, let's just look at from autarky to geographic integration. This is showing you starting in 1950 and going up to 2010. It's just the percentage of students in the US who apply to a post-secondary institution that is at least 250 miles distant. So certainly they cannot commute to this sort of institution. The top line there in dark blue is the highest aptitude students who score above the 90th percentile on college assessments. The middle line is median aptitude students, and the bottom line is marginally college prepared students, students who do take a college assessment, but they're towards the bottom of the distribution. And the first thing that you'll notice is that although they all start out sort of the same, most of them are just going to their local institution in 1950, by 2010, 90% of the highest aptitude students are applying to at least one post-secondary institution that is 250 miles from their home. And that's the remaining 10%, by the way, a lot of them, it's because they live in New York City or Boston or something where there are a lot of post-secondary institutions. Okay. So there's also a big rise, obviously, for the median student, but it's less dramatic. And there hasn't been very much of a change for the marginally prepared college-going students. Okay, let's look at how students were sorted to educational resources in 1967. This is really the first year in which we can do this accurately. So what do I have here? On the horizontal axis, I have each post-secondary institution's per student expenditure on instruction, and it's in rank. Okay, so if you had 5,000 places and you spent $10,000 a year, then I'm going to give you 5,000 rank places, and then this school that spends 9,999 is going to have the next places below you. Okay, so it's literally rank in the US. So all the schools are just ranked from top to bottom. And then I've ranked students' aptitude also from top to bottom based on their college assessment scores. Obviously, there are ties here, okay? Right. So what you can see in it, so first of all, if all the students were such that the highest aptitude student was going to the highest spending school, okay, we would all, and the lowest aptitude student was going to the lowest spending school, we would obviously be on the 45 degree line, right? Okay. And you can see that in 1967, that's really not true at all. There's a bit of an indication here that some higher aptitude students are perhaps getting higher educational resources per student, but there's not very much sorting, okay? If we look at exactly the same graph in 2013, we can see it looks rather different. First of all, for the more selective schools, we can see that there's a lot of assortative matching between educational resources and student aptitude. And then you can also see that assortative matching starts to disappear as we move down the aptitude and resources distribution. So these are the most selective schools in the United States. They're all nonprofits. These are what I'm going to call very selective from now on. They're a mix of public flagship universities, things like that, and nonprofit private institutions. These are selective institutions, so they're still selective. Okay, they're still looking at college assessment scores, high school grades, things like that. They're just not very selective. That's actually a mix of all three types of governance, public, nonprofit, for-profit. And then finally, we have the non-selectives, which are actually the dominant type of institution in the US and the type of institution where most students go. Okay, so all of you are overexposed to that most selective group, but the non-selectives are where most students in the United States go. And you can see that looks more or less like a cloud. I don't really see a lot of sorting going on down there. And that the non-selectives are mainly publics and for-profits, but there are a few nonprofits there as well. Okay, so lots of assortative matching, especially in the more selective institutions. And then the final point I said I would show you was that this was all made possible by increasing tuition subsidies for high aptitude students. This is from a paper of mine that's in the Journal of Economic Perspectives. That's why it stops in 2007, but it just keeps going up after that. Okay, so what are we looking at here? We're looking at the average subsidy per student for schools that are at different selectivity quantiles. Okay, so first of all, what is the average subsidy per student? Well, you take the amount that's being spent on instruction, student services, and academic support. That's what is spent on undergraduates. I think that's calculated actually quite accurately. I'd be glad to answer questions about that. And then subtract the amount of tuition paid. Okay, so that's the average subsidy per student. It could be coming from alumni donations, it could be coming from the state government, which has made an appropriation to the school, which allows it to have tuition be much lower than what it's spending. It comes from something like that. Okay, this top line is for the schools that were most selective in 1962. That's the 99th percentile, actually. If you read the paper, you'll see that schools don't really change rank order that much between 1962 and today, so these are the same schools that are the most selective today. It wouldn't really matter if I did the graph based on selectivity today, but I'm keeping the schools on the same line. Okay, so that's the 99th percentile, then we have the 95th through the 98th, the 91st through the 95th, and so on down to the least selective schools. So what do we see here? We see that there's an obvious massive increase for the most selective schools in the average subsidy per student. And that is what has enabled these schools to draw more and more high aptitude students in, because not all high aptitude students come from rich families who could afford to pay the full tuition at these schools. In fact, really very few of their students could afford to pay. By today, the average student at the top schools in the United States is paying under 20% of the cost of his or her education. Even a full-pay student is usually paying no more than half. Okay. So that gives you a sense of the subsidies. All right, so now I'm going to compute institutions' productivity. How am I going to do this? Well, first I want to define what I'm going to use as my measure of productivity. I could do it different ways, but this is what I'm going to do today. The numerator is going to be the causal increase in lifetime earnings triggered by enrolling in an institution. Okay, I'm going to call that value added from now on. And then the denominator is going to be the causal increase in lifetime educational spending triggered by enrolling in the institution. And I'm going to call that social investment, okay? Because it's not just going to be what you paid in tuition, it's going to be the cost to society, which might include the cost to the government or coming from an endowment or whatever else. And note also that it's the causal increase in lifetime educational spending. So let's say I go to University of Chicago and my alternative was some other university that we'll call B University so that it can remain unnamed. Well, if University of Chicago induces me to go to graduate school or medical school or something like that, by going to University of Chicago, I'm somehow triggered to do those things. It's not merely that I had to pay University of Chicago for 4 years and some other people paid for my University of Chicago education for 4 years. I also then stay in school longer, okay, and I have bigger lifetime spending than I otherwise would. So it's not just the 4 years, but it's anything that's triggered by that, okay? So what's the problem? Why can't I just, you know, look at lifetime earnings and divide by lifetime educational spending? The problem is really that there's enormous bias from vertical and horizontal selection. And you can guess that that's going to be true because I just showed you a bunch of graphs that basically gave you the evidence that we were going to have a lot of vertical selection or assortative matching. So the vertical selection problem is that schools enroll students who differ in aptitude, and it isn't the case that you can just look at the raw earnings from a place like Harvard and say, well, gee, everyone would have, you know, that's just all Harvard's value added. That's not true. Okay, and horizontal selection is probably, it's a little less of a problem, but it's still a problem. You know, schools, kids who go to school in Mississippi are may not have the same, even if they're equally apt, they may not have the same circumstances or the same labor market as students who go to school in New York City. Okay, so that's horizontal selection. And it's a large, geography is the most important thing there. Okay, so what am I going to do? I'm going to apply the following method. I'm going to deal with vertical selection by finding each school students who are on the bubble. By on the bubble, for the non-Americans, on the bubble is a phrase that means sort of you're just about to make it or you're just about to not make it. So sometimes we'll say, you know, I was on the bubble for making the swimming team, or this state is on the bubble for voting versus Democrat or Republican. It means it could go either way. You're right on the bubble? Okay. And I'm going to treat students who are in the bubble range as randomized by admission staff. So remember, they're being randomized by the admissions staff. Okay. And the result of that, of finding all of these students who were on the bubble at some school, is that I'm going to get a lot of comparisons between institutions A and B, where College B is just a little less selective than College A. You shouldn't think of that, it's not going to be I was on the bubble to get into Harvard and I didn't get in and I went to community college. That's very rare, okay? Most of the students who are on the bubble at Harvard go to some other school that is a little less selective if they don't get in, all right? I'm gonna deal with horizontal selection by finding students who are choosing among colleges that are in an indifferent set. By this I mean that the schools are very equal in terms of selectivity. And I'm going to treat the students as randomizing among them, sort of flipping coins between two institutions that look very similar in terms of selectivity, but may have produced different outcomes. And that's going to give us many A versus C type of experiments where A and C have very similar students, but they may have different outcomes. And then I'm going to use paired comparison methods to combine the results of all of these pairwise experiments. So you can think of every time a student is, you know, choosing between A and B or A and C, that's a little experiment. And I'm going to combine all of those experiments. So we're talking about, you know, millions of experiments. I'm going to combine millions of experiments using paired-wide comparison methods. And if you're not familiar with them, the nice way to think about them is that they are the same methods that we use for ranking tennis players, chess players, football teams, everything else. It's a statistical sort of method that says I'm going to take a lot of pairwise competitions, or it could be more than pairwise, but anyway, pairwise competitions, and I'm going to come out with one overall ranking, okay? And so, you know, if you're thinking about tennis, which is my favorite example, and you're interested in whether Federer is better than Rafael Nadal, you're gonna see, look at their head-to-head competitions, but you're also going to see how well they do when they're playing Djokovic, and how well they do when they're playing the person who's number 20, and so forth and so on. All of that information gets fed into pairwise comparison methods. Great sort of statistical method, and I'm delighted to talk to any of you about the ranking of American college football afterwards, because I learned like a whole lot about it that turns out to not be terribly useful for the paper. Okay, so, but now I know, so, okay. So a little bit more on the vertical experiments, which are the ones that I think are more difficult for people to understand. The way this works is that college admission staff do admissions in a fairly systematic way, based largely on academic criteria for most of a college class in the United States in a selective college, and they sort of fill most of the class that way. And then they review a set of students who are on the bubble, okay? They usually are students who are not the lowest scoring students who they admit. They are below the median for that school's enrolled students, but they're not a lot below the median. That's a typical on the bubble range. And they look at these students because they're going to be fine students. They're not going to be spectacular. They're going to be fine students. But at this point, they're trying to round out the class. So if they realize, gee, we don't have anyone who's going to play in the school orchestra, this is the time to find some people to play in the school orchestra. This is the time to find people who are going to be interested in some field of study, something like that. So they're fairly indifferent between these students, except on some ground. And the idea is that the students are admitted based on some factor that matters to the shape of the class, but it's just too minor to plausibly affect their lifetime outcomes except through this admission rejection decision. Okay, so we're going to treat them as being randomized by admission staff. And how do I find the bubble range? Well, my favorite method is using structural break methods because it tends to show where the bubble range is. And for those of you who, you know, want to think about it as kind of being a little bit like a fuzzy RD, that's not a bad intuition, okay? It's a reasonable intuition. If I had a fuzzy cut for admissions, this might be it's another way of thinking about it. But as I said, they're usually just a little below the median. Okay, the horizontal experiments are much easier to understand. A student's just considering two institutions, let's call them off the top of my head, Princeton and Yale, that happen to be very similarly selective, and you're gonna choose one based on some factor that's too small to affect you except through going to one institution versus another, like I like Gothic architecture versus I like New England Georgian architecture. Okay. All right, so why combine the results of all the head-to-head experiments? Well, it's the same as the Rafael Nadal Federer example that I gave you before. If we ignore how well they do when they're playing versus Djokovic or somebody who's the number 20 player, then we're just ignoring information, right? There's a lot of information in all of those other experiments, and I've given you a strict example here, but I think you guys can all get it for yourselves, so we're gonna go on and just let me summarize the method and talk about its strengths. And you know it has weaknesses too. I'd be the first to admit this is not perfect, right? Unless someone allows me to randomize students to colleges and then watch them for the rest of their lives, it's not going to be perfect. So this is as good as I think I can do, okay? And it requires a ton of data, as you'll see in a second. All right, so what's the method? I'm gonna gather all these differences in earnings and social investment from all the vertical experiments that involve a student who's on the bubble. I'm gonna do the same thing for all the horizontal experiments involving students who choose between equally selective schools, and I'm going to combine the experimental results using paired comparison techniques. So what's the strength of this? The strength is that we probably remove most, or maybe even all, of the selection bias, Common support is always fulfilled. I'm never comparing someone who could, you know, get into Harvard and someone who could never get into Harvard and saying, oh, there are differences in outcomes, that's probably the value added of Harvard University. Okay, it's always common support. All right, I think that is the key thing, actually. If I could just emphasize one thing, it is common support is always fulfilled. Students are never, institutions are never being compared based on students who would not be able to go to both institutions. Okay, that's the crucial thing. The paired comparison methods impose no form whatsoever on the relationships between value added and aptitude, so there's no, you know, value added doesn't have to be linear in aptitude or quadratic or anything, nothing like that, okay? And it's very obvious which assumptions need robustness testing, and I'll just tell you the one that is the most important one, and that is how I choose the on-the-bubble students, or the on-the-bubble range. And there's a lot of robustness checking in the paper about that, okay? Finally, I have no fix for the problem of selection between not going to post-secondary school at all versus going to post-secondary school. You all may have your favorite instrument for that out in the audience. If you have your favorite instrument, from now on, you can believe that that is the return to going to post-secondary school at all versus not enrolling at all. I am just going to normalize the value added for the lowest value added schools to zero. Okay, that's purely a normalization. So from now on, I don't want you to pay too much attention to the level, because that's the normalization speaking a lot of the time. But I want you to pay attention to the differences in productivity among post-secondary institutions. Okay, so look at the patterns. Don't pay too much attention to the level, because that's a normalization. All right, so what data do I need to apply this method? A lot. So this is all administrative data, and it's all population data. There's no survey data. There's no sample data here at all. It's 100% population data. So I have college assessment scores. For the population. I have enrollment from the National Student Clearinghouse. I have wage and salary earnings, including zero earnings from Form W-2s from the Treasury. And I have social spending for all post-secondary institutions. So social spending is this spending on instruction, academic support, student services, and institutional support. So it's not just coming from what tuition students pay, but it's from all the sources that fund that sort of spending. And I think, I think that social spending is quite good even for research universities, and ask me a question about that if you're worried about that in the question period. It's about 3 million students per cohort, and for today's evidence, I'm just going to use one particular cohort, and those are the students who were graduates in the year 2000, high school graduates in the year 2000, so they're about age 33 in 2014. All right, let's look at some of the data. These are their raw wages are shown in blue, and the value added that I've calculated based on their 2014 wages, so this is just 1 year's worth of wages, is shown in red. And you can see that wages go up monotonically with the college's selectivity. So I was kind of stupid, and I didn't tell you what was on the horizontal axis here, but it's very important. It's the SAT math plus verbal score of the institution's mean student, okay, and I've just binned them into 20-point bins. Okay, so there's 1,500 at the very top. Those are extremely selective institutions. 500 at the bottom. That's about the minimum you can possibly score on the SAT combined. Okay, so we have the whole range of selectivity. And this is, mind you, this is for the institution's mean student. So what you're looking at here is institutions. Okay, that's key, because sometimes people get confused and think they're looking at students. No, this is, I'm putting an institution in based on its mean student. Okay, so these are more selective institutions, less selective institutions, right? Okay, fine. The vertical axis is, of course, just wages and value added, so that's pretty obvious. Okay, so what we see is that there is a monotonic relationship between raw wages and the college's selectivity, which isn't too surprising. There's also a monotonic relationship between value added and the college's selectivity, but notice that it is the value added line is a lot goes up a lot less quickly than wages. And by the time we get to the most selective institutions, you can see that about two-thirds of wages do not look like they are the value added of the institutions. That's just the fact that they have very high aptitude students who are going to earn pretty high wages anyway. Okay? All right, so that's just for 1 year. And there are my ranges again, just to kind of remind you where things are. Okay, so the most selective, very selective, selective, and then the non-selectives. All right. This is the predicted present value from age 18 to age 65, okay? But basically the same thing. So we have the raw earnings, the PDV, the present discounted value of the raw earnings, and everything I discount by 2.5% real. In the paper, I use other discount rates as well, but That's what I'm showing you today, is 2.5% real. And value added is in the red. And you can see again that what we see this, the monotonicity, which is not surprising since we saw it already in wages by 2014. And it's there, but again, the value added line rises much more slowly than the PDV of lifetime earnings. Okay. So that, the way I project it out a couple different ways, but I am able to observe students until their early 30s or mid 30s, and then I have to project it out to age 65. I do this a few different ways, and they don't make that much of a difference except for the very, very top dot there, the most selective schools, and we could talk about that too, because that's kind of cool. Anyway, but I'll leave that for the question period. All right, so this now is showing you the dispersion in value added. So I've gotten rid of raw earnings, raw wages, they're gone. We're only gonna look now, from now on, at value added. And what this graph is showing you is the mean is that same line we saw before. This is actually only from age 18 to age to 2014, so the early 30s, about age 33, okay? And I wanted to show you this so that you knew it wasn't anything about my predicting it out to age 65. It has nothing to do with that. That's not involved here, okay? And what you can see is that there isn't very much dispersion at the most selective schools. So this is the 95th percentile institution in this category. This is the 5th percentile institution in this category. This is the mean in this category, okay? It's just not, the differences are not that dispersed. The value add is not that dispersed. As we go to less and less selective institutions, dispersion increases and increases quite dramatically as we get into the non-selective range. So that the non-selective institutions have value added that's really kind of all over the place, right? And that's going to be an important thing for us when we think about what explains the data. Okay, that was all value added, the numerator. Now let's look at the denominator for a moment. The denominator, so it's same method, but just applied to different data. In the blue line is showing you tuition paid, and the red dots are showing you social post-secondary investment, which includes all the money that comes from other sources. And of course, you'll notice right away that both of them are pretty much monotonic in colleges' selectivity. More selective colleges spend more per student and charge and have higher tuition paid. But notice that social investment goes up much more steeply at the most selective institutions than tuition paid does. And that's all those subsidies, right, which we saw in the previous graph, that the subsidies are very high at those institutions. Okay, so now what we have is, for productivity, we have a kind of race. We know that value added is going up somewhat monotonically, and we know that social investment is going up monotonically, and what's going to happen to productivity is going to be sort of a race between those two things, which are both going up with selectivity. And this is the graph that inspired me to give this talk. Because when I produced this graph for the first time, I looked at it and I just thought, ooh, that is not what I expected. Okay, this is that numerator, value added from age 18 to age 65, divided by that social post-secondary investment over your lifetime. And the first thing to notice about it is that over a wide range of selectivity, it's actually fairly flat. Right? There just isn't a lot of action. I'm not saying that it's exactly flat. There's actually a little bit of an upward slope here, but it's pretty flat. Right? And then the other thing to notice is there's this obvious break, and the break occurs really between the non-selectives and the selectives. Okay? These are all, if you're scoring around like 700, if your mean student is scoring 700 on the SAT, you're a non-selective institution. I mean, we can check that via a whole bunch of other means, but these are the non-selectives, and these are all the different selectives, okay? And it's quite flat among the selectives. So I was totally struck by this because it was not what I expected, but it suggests that productivity is not changing a lot in selectivity over a wide range of the distribution of selectivity, although it is lower for the non-selectives. So from now on, I don't want to show you all those little dots, so I'm going to show you a local polynomial. I'm just showing you the local polynomial. And from now on, it's going to look like that. Okay, so no more dots. All right. Dispersion in productivity. Yeah, well, okay, I lied. All right, so so dispersion in productivity. So I just was showing the average level. Now I'm showing you the dispersion in productivity. And what you can see, which is not going to surprise you at all, is that productivity gets much more dispersed as we go from the most selective schools to the least selective schools. And that shouldn't surprise you because I already showed you that value added got a lot more dispersed. So that almost has to be true. Okay. All right. So that's one way of showing you the dispersion in productivity. Another way of showing you is to just show you the 95-5 difference in productivity between the 95th percentile and the 5th percentile institution, and you can see that it just pretty much declines monotonically with selectivity. Okay, so from now on, I'm going to show you just this purple line or lines that are analogous to it, and that's how I'm going to show you that how dispersion changes with selectivity. All right, so let's have a few simple takeaways at this point, just to kind of gather things up. First, if I don't correct for selection, clearly there's going to be a tremendous amount of bias, right? Because the raw earnings and stuff like that is just going to be very misleading. Unless the normalization is very wrong, investments in selective post-secondary education pay off well. I told you not to pay too much attention to the levels, but the normalization would have to be really, really wrong. Like the least selective institutions or the non-selectives would have to have a really negative effect on value added, which they could have because they're depriving you of years in the labor market, but they'd have to have a really negative effect for selective college education to not pay off pretty well. The value added is higher for more selective institutions. This is already so by age 33. It doesn't really depend on whether I go out to age 65 or not. Okay, and but because such institutions also trigger the higher social post-secondary investment, we saw that productivity was actually quite flat, even though these two relationships are both going up monotonically. Here are the striking facts that any good model, I think, of our post-secondary market needs to explain. The first is this assortative matching between student aptitude and resources in a rank-rank sense, and how that's grown over time. The second is that average productivity is roughly similar across a wide range of selectivity, which, as I said, was a surprise to me. That average productivity is lower at non-selective institutions, that productivity is not terribly dispersed among the most selective institutions, and that the dispersion in productivity among institutions rises as selectivity falls. Okay, so those are the facts that a model needs to explain. Let me just lay out a model that is very familiar to people in this area, but may not be as familiar to you all. Let's suppose that there's single crossing in the productivity of student aptitude and educational resources. By that, I just mean that if you're a higher aptitude student, you make better use of every marginal dollar of educational resources. Now, this is a very common assumption in this area, but let's just assume it, okay? You don't have to believe it, but let's just assume it and think about its implications. Let's assume that students maximize their earnings, or utility, something like that, but earnings are good enough for us. Students are elastic with respect to any arbitrary features of geography, so they're going to just go to the institution that maximizes their earnings and be, you know, they're not going to have a lot of disutility of distance or something like that. That's going to make all institutions well integrated into the market because students will only choose an institution if it's the one that maximizes their earnings. And let's assume that there are mechanisms that allow each student to act like a fully efficient, informed investor. So they're going to understand the implications of going to any institution, and they're going to have financing mechanisms so that they're not going to be liquidity constrained or anything like that. Obviously these are not totally realistic assumptions. But if that is the model, what are we going to get? We're going to get student choices and market forces generating an assortatively matched equilibrium where higher resources are matched with more apt students. And crucially, each dollar of resources is going to generate about the same value added, and institutions are going to be forced to be productively or ex-efficient. Okay? Now, this model there's nothing surprising about it or new about it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the model because I don't think it's an innovation at all here. It's the same model that will come out of general equilibrium, say, for TIBU or this model's been written down by Eppel and Romano. It's not a new model. Okay, but what do you get from this model? What are the necessary conditions for equilibrium? Stratification and positive assortive matching, that students going to more selective schools if they're more apt and they get matched with more educational resources. Allocative efficiency, the equalization of the marginal return to a dollar of social investment, and productive efficiency, forcing institutions out to the PPF. Okay. All right, so this model seems like it sort of fits the more selective institutions. Not perfectly, but it looks like there is some explanatory power of the model. Why does it fit the high aptitude and selective institutions much better? And it really does not seem to fit those non-selective institutions well. Well, there are at least three possible explanations, although I can think of others too, but the three prime ones are, I think, information, that the students who go to the more selective institutions are better informed about themselves, about their aptitude, and about the institutions and what those institutions do, and the outcomes that they might have if they go to one institution versus another. Elasticity, So another explanation is that high aptitude students are very sensitive to their match with college's resources and quite insensitive to distance, whereas maybe lower aptitude students are more sensitive to things like distance or more sensitive to other aspects of match which are horizontal. So it doesn't have to be geography, but geography seems very important. It could also be a match to an institution in some other fashion, but educational resources are not the thing that I'm looking at. And then finally, incentives that flow through financing, and I'm going to talk about that a little because I think that's really important as well. And the idea is that the students, the institutions and the students who are going to the more selective institutions have different financing than the students who are going to the non-selective institutions, and that incentives for productivity differ when you use different methods of financing higher education. So we'll get into that. So what we're going to see is first whether the model better fits the institutions and the students for whom these assumptions about information elasticity and financing are more realistic. Remember, we assumed very efficient financing. Okay, so I'm going to show you the information-based test first because it's the easiest one. So the model implies that productivity will be lower and more dispersed in parts of the market where information is scarce. And what I'm going to do is just look at whether productivity is more dispersed and lower among institutions that do not participate in college guides. And by that, I mean something specific. I mean they do not participate in what's called the common data set. That is the data set that underlies all of the big college guides in the United States, Peterson's, Barron's Guide, U.S. News & World Report. They all basically fill out, you can fill out this survey, it's voluntary. It's a very time-consuming survey, believe me. And if you don't participate in it, you won't be in any of those college guides. Okay? All right, so that's just to remind you of what the level of productivity looked like. Now let me show you that for schools that do and do not participate in the common data set. The green line shows you the schools that do not give information to the common data set. The orange line shows you institutions that do give information to the common data set. Obviously, all the most selective ones do. A lot of the least selective ones do not. That's almost no non-selective ones give information to the common data set. But there is an area of overlap. And in that area of overlap, you can see that the institutions that give information to the common data set are significantly more productive than those that do not, suggesting that, you know, maybe information is playing a role. Okay, this is the dispersion of productivity graph. You remember seeing that before. Let's look at that again. Here we have the institutions that do not give information to the common data set. Their productivity is more dispersed than the institutions that do give information to the common data set. Looking like part of what is going on here is, again, dispersion is possible because without information, there's not very much disciplining of productivity. All right. What about a market integration-based test? So the model implies that productivity will be lower and more dispersed among institutions that are poorly integrated into the market. And the way I'm going to try and test this is by looking at institutions whose students apply to either numerous schools, suggesting that the students are kind of making active choices and comparing schools, or students only apply to the school itself. Okay. So that's, again, our level of productivity graph. Here it is when I divide it. I've put some institutions in where at least 75% of the students apply only to the school itself. That really often means no application at all. They just walk down, fill out some paperwork, okay? And institutions at which at least 75% of the students apply to at least three schools. Again, there's not common support everywhere, but in the area where there is common support, we notice that the institutions where the students are applying to more schools seem to have higher productivity, suggesting that that choice mechanism disciplines the school's productivity. We'll also see that if we look at dispersion, the institutions at which at least 75% of the school students apply to basically only the school itself have much more dispersed productivity than the schools that are much better integrated because the students are making more active choices in the market. Okay, finally, I want to talk about financing a little bit, and I have very few minutes left, so you're going to see me go fast. All right, so the model implies that productivity will be lower and more dispersed in institutions whose students depend on financing mechanisms that give students give institutions an incentive to be productive. So let me just run through the main financing mechanisms in the United States very briefly. Internal family finance, okay, this depends on the parents having assets to pay for the child's education. The implications for productivity are that families have an incentive to pressure institutions to be productive. Obviously, this is only going to work for institutions where a lot of the parents are able to finance their child's education. So it doesn't work equally well for all institutions. The next mechanism is student loans with rational underwriting. This is a super interesting topic. This isn't used a lot, though, in the United States right now. Just think of it as being a lot like family finances. But it's another way of disciplining institutions that are not productive because rational underwriting would give the unproductive institutions, students, worse loan rates than, and lower loan volumes than it would give to students who attend productive institutions. The university is a venture capitalist. I've written about this in a couple of other papers. So this applies to those very selective nonprofit institutions. In these schools, the institution subsidizes current students with alumni gifts and gets an implicit equity-like stake in the students' future earnings. And this is really how a place like, say, Princeton operates. Okay, it doesn't charge students nearly the cost of their education, but it figures out how to go after them for the rest of their lives, and it's good at doing it. And the result is that one generation finances another, and the institution works as a somewhat like a venture capitalist. This seems only necessary and seems to apply only to very apt students where social investments are very large and information asymmetries are potentially, would be very damaging. Okay, what are the implications for productivity? Well, the institution itself is the one that suffers if its productivity is low. So in some ways, this mechanism should generate lots of pressure to be productive. I don't always notice this at my own institution. And maybe that's because to sustain the mechanism, the institutions also have to spend a lot on loyalty-enhancing goods, like all those orange sweatshirts that they wear at Princeton. Okay, government appropriations. You all know what those are. Government subsidize current students by funding appropriations that reduce tuition at institutions, like state schools. The implications for productivity are kind of ambiguous because on the one hand, the government itself should internalize having non-productive institutions. You know, if Berkeley is not productive, then the state of California should be worried about it because it's going to end up with those graduates. So maybe the state of California will discipline Berkeley, but on the other hand, you know, current politicians don't always think that far ahead, okay? And on the other hand, the government appropriation mechanism means that students can only receive subsidies by enrolling at certain government-controlled institutions. Sam Peltzman noted this long ago. And this gives public institutions substantial market power and therefore weakens the kind of the forces for being productive that would come from comparing private and public institutions. Government grants, federal taxpayers are funding these. These are portable among institutions, so you don't have that non-portability thing that Sam Peltzman talked about. But unless there's an institution explicit graduate tax, which if really no one has, institutions can free ride and have little incentive to be productive. Student choices here should discipline institutions, but the sort of students who get a lot of student grants who depend on that a lot may not be the best disciplinarians. Okay, they tend to be low-income students, veterans, people who are probably not the most elastic, most informed students. And then finally, is student loans that aren't going to be repaid in expectation. There are a lot of student loans like this in the United States. I could talk about this more. But the implications for productivity are the same as for grants. All right, so I'm just going to show you one graph and then give you a few numbers, and then we're going to stop. Okay, the most striking graph here is there's our level of productivity graph. And now I'm showing you institutions that depend a lot on federal grants versus institutions that depend almost not at all on federal grants. And the interesting thing is that in the non-selective sector, both of these types of institutions exist. Okay, that is really what's interesting about this graph, that there are institutions that are non-selective where less than 5% of the revenue comes from federal grants, and there are institutions at which at least 80% of the revenue comes from federal grants. And if you were to add up all the types of federal grants, including grants to veterans, and if you were to add in the non-paying back student loans, it would be 100%. Okay, so there's really extreme differences in the non-selectives here. Many institutions that are represented here are for-profit institutions, and their productivity just varies enormously depending on whether they are mainly depending on people paying for their own education or they're mainly depending on federal grants. So the federal grant-dependent institutions are just much, much less selective. In general, if I run a regression, and I put in a dummy for every single level of selectivity. So I just totally dummy out selectivity. And then I put in covariates that pick up how much of the funding is coming from these various different sources. Schools that depend more on family financing and loans with rational underwriting tend to be more productive. Alumni gifts I have as my omitted category. Appropriations is mildly negative, although it turns positive for very selective flagship public institutions who actually face a lot of choice, so that's not terribly surprising to me. Federal grants are negative, and loans with irrational underwriting are also negative for productivity. Okay, so let me just conclude here. I think what we've learned is that fairly apt students who are enrolling in a selective institution seem to be making fairly sound investments. It's a little less obvious for the non-selective schools, although, because that's that normalization. Market forces seem to induce schools to be fairly equally productive about across a range of selectivity. I found this totally shocking, okay? And the reason is that that's what we would expect if the schools were ordinary investments with non-distorted prices and students were just nice investors who were flexible, competitive, rational, informed, you know, interchangeable. Okay, I didn't really expect that because I don't think those things are true. But somehow there is enough going on there in terms of reasonable market forces that this seems to be happening. Notice that saying that they're fairly equally productive does not mean that they're all on the PPF. Okay, they could all be taking rents, but it's just a similar amount. And there are multiple explanations for the lower and dispersed productivity of the non-selectives. But I think two things we want to take away from that are that students can make big mistakes when they're attending non-selectives, because there are some that are much more productive than others. And any of the estimates that we've produced on the return to going to college versus not is typically high school versus one of the non-selectives. And depending on which non-selective you choose, you're going to get a very different answer, right? So you have to be careful about extrapolating from those sorts of lessons. And then finally, some general lessons for post-secondary education, which I think we should, you know, don't just apply to the US. The first is that single crossing seems to be a very powerful feature of higher education. The more the market is allocating resources, the more the allocation exhibits what looks like assortative matching. This is not just richer students buying more costly education. In fact, we kind of saw that the opposite is true, as there's been more assortative matching. It depends less on parents' income. And this maybe doesn't apply to less apt students. Competition seems to matter. Okay. Information seems to matter. And different financing schemes that generate different incentives for institutions to be productive also seem to matter. So I'll stop at that point. Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to answer questions.